Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 10, 2014. The South Sudan Army spokesman says the rebels of the SPLM in opposition appear to be approaching Bentiu town.
Most of the rebels commanders are engaged in an intensive mobilization and they are gathering their forces in particular areas with intention to launch an attack.
And a new report says Sudanese and Eritrean political asylum seekers are being forced to leave Israel.
Our report includes testimony from Sudanese who have returned to Sudan who have faced detention, interrogation, torture, and treason charges.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan Army says it has received credible reports that opposition forces are mobilizing to attack Unity State Capital Bentiu in violation of ceasefire agreement signed in January and recommitted to again by both parties in May. There is no independent confirmation of the impending reports of attack from international and local agencies in Unity State. VOA fellow Michael Atit has more from Washington.
SPLA spokesperson Colonel Philip Aguirre says the past 3 weeks have been relatively calm in Unity, Upper Nile and Jonglei states following nearly 8 months of fighting between government and rebel forces loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. Aguirre says the situation changed after the opposition leader refused to acknowledge signing a blueprint, also known as Matrix, for ceasefire last month.
Our observation in the field is that most of the rebels' commanders are engaged in an intensive mobilization and they are gathering their forces in particular areas with intention to launch an attack which their leaders promised that they will launch all over operations if their terms of agreement are not accepted. So we are expecting operation in Unity State, particularly in Bentiu areas of Mayom and Pariang, around oil fields, and then areas of northern Upper Nile, the same in oil areas.
Aguirre warned the army will defend areas under its control if attacked. He says all ceasefire violations are being reported to monitors with IGAD, which is mediating the Addis Ababa peace talks. He says, despite what the rebels are doing, President Salva Kiir has instructed government troops to respect the ceasefire.
The quicker the peace comes, the better for our people. And we are concerned that the people of these regions of all Upper Nile continue to suffer. And that is a shame on all of us. And we hope peace will come soon.
However, the opposition military spokesperson Lul Rai Kong, who is in Addis Ababa, has denied rebel forces are planning to attack Bentiu. At least 10,000 people have died and nearly 2 million people have been displaced since the fighting began in mid-December. The United Nations Peacekeeping Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, is sheltering more than 100,000 South Sudanese, many of whom have witnessed deadly violence and do not feel it is safe to return home. Conditions in some of the UNMISS camps have been described by humanitarian agencies as deplorable. International humanitarian organizations have warned of a looming famine later this year if the conflict is not resolved soon. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
This report was written and prepared by Philip Aleu in Juba with contribution from VOA fellow Lucy Pony in Washington. A day after President Kiir signed 3 new media bills into laws which are supposed to be given to journalists to have them to... I repeat that again. A day after President Salva Kiir signed 3 new bills into laws which are supposed to give journalists easy access to information, a media rights group say a reporter for the UN-sponsored Miraya FM has been in detention for nearly 3 weeks. The Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, says The reporter, George Livio, was given no explanation by the authorities as to why he was arrested in Wau on August 22nd. VOA fellow Lucy Pony reports from Washington.
The CPJ's East Africa representative, Tom Rhodes, says journalists work in a tough environment in South Sudan, and it's going from bad to worse in spite of the signing into law of the media bills. He says that under South Sudan's penal code, the authorities in South Sudan must release Livio or take him to court within 24 hours of detaining him.
Our main concern is that he's been held for over 2 weeks, I mean nearly 3 weeks actually, without any charges or without being presented in court. So we're calling on the security agents to do that, especially in light of the recent passage of the media law.
Livio has not been charged with any offence, but Rhodes says that Western Barelgazal State Information Minister Derek Alfred told CPJ that security agents monitored Livio's communications and accused him of collaborating with rebels. Livio's family and his employers say that's not true. Over the weekend, South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe told journalists at a forum about the role of media in nation building that journalists who report the views of rebels led by Dr. Riek Machar are, quote, rebels and agitators and could face prosecution. Makwe made a similar statement in March when he said it was a criminal offense to broadcast or publish interviews with rebels. Rhodes says journalists in South Sudan who talk to the armed opposition are merely trying to do their job and report both sides of the biggest story in the country at the moment, the nine-month-old conflict. Rhodes says comments like Makwe's illustrate that.
Things are getting worse in South Sudan since independence in 2011. The only kind of comments that the information minister made was warning journalists not to step on their toes, you know, in quotes, and to stop reporting on the rebels, otherwise they'd be considered agitators. We're really seeing a kind of a zero-tolerance policy towards objective and professional reporting in South Sudan due to this conflict, and my fear is that things may get worse before they get better.
Livio was moved from Wau to Juba on August 24th, 2 days after he was detained. He has been denied legal aid and contact with family. His father, Geligo Livio, who is an economic advisor for the Western Barelgazal state government, says,
"We don't know where he's being held in Juba, and we only hear that he is in the hands of the security. Secondly, we don't know now what are the charges against him. So far, I've been struggling to get in touch with him by phone, but it cannot go through."
The CPJ says it knows of at least 10 journalists who have been threatened or harassed by security officials since the start of the conflict in South Sudan. Because of what the CPJ calls a steady flow of intimidation, many journalists in South Sudan are self-censoring their work and not reporting on key issues at a time when the country needs accurate and truthful reporting. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Washington, D.C.
VOA fellow Michael Atid contributed to this report. Human Rights Watch has released a report accusing Israel of unlawfully coercing thousands of Sudanese and Eritrean nationals into returning to their home countries where they will face arbitrary detention and even torture. VOA fellow Nabil Biagio has more.
Jerry Simpson is the lead author of the 83-page report entitled Make Their Lives Miserable. He describes Israel's treatment of the asylum seekers as
a series of coercive policies Israel has introduced to coerce Eritreans and Sudanese to leave the country.
The report says Sudanese and Eritrean refugees who have been arriving in Israel in big numbers since 2006 are held in remote desert detention centers and are barred from obtaining proper immigration documents, which they need in order to work. Simpson says the detainees are held in a sort of legal limbo. They have temporary insecure status, which must be renewed every few months in a chaotic procedure that forces them to stand in long queues outside. They also live in what the detainees describe as a prison, where they must sign in at a roll call 3 times a day. Detainee Mu'tasim Ali from Darfur, Sudan, is being held in the Holot Residency Center, which Simpson calls a detention center.
So we're not allowed to work and we're not allowed to leave this facility for any reason.
Simpson says 7,000 Eritrean and Sudanese nationals returned from Israel to their home countries because of the mistreatment, and many were subjected to torture upon their return.
Our report includes testimony from Sudanese who have returned to Sudan who have faced detention, interrogation, torture, and treason charges.
Simpson says he hopes the report will draw attention to Israel's mistreatment of Sudanese and Eritrean asylum seekers.
We're hoping that Israel's allies in Washington in particular and European countries concerned with the fate of Eritreans and Sudanese coerced back to possible torture and abuse will encourage Israel to respect its obligations under international law, which prohibits such forced return, and to use its asylum system to properly and fairly process the asylum claims of these people.
For Mu'tasim, going back to Sudan is not an option. He says not only will he face persecution, but the Khartoum government will punish his entire family because of his decision to flee to Israel. He says his father was imprisoned by the Sudanese authorities in 2009 when they learned that Mu'tasim had made it to Israel through Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, a long and harrowing journey all refugees from Sudan and Eritrea have to take in order to get to Israel. Mu'tasim says he thought a country like Israel would have more compassion for oppressed people.
We didn't expect this from Israel, a country that experienced the same tragedies that we are going through now. It's really disappointing to come to Israel and just find yourself have to be in the prison for an indefinite period, kind of a mistreatment, and we see all this hostile reception.
A proposal was made a few months ago to deport Sudanese and Eritrean refugees from Israel to a third-party country instead of their countries of origin, but such agreements have not been made public. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
The people of the nation, the best thing that they can do is to try as best as possible to cooperate with the health authorities and to listen to and adhere to the suggestions and guidelines. We appreciate that this is something that is really awful to be going through. We're with you, we have solidarity with you, and hopefully we'll be able to end this terrible epidemic very soon.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the International Committee of Red Cross warns thousands of South Sudanese may face starvation. That report is coming up next.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on the events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We're also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That is South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what role do you think education plays in the development of a country?
Very huge. It's been scientifically proved that the higher the level of education of a society, the greater the growth of that society. Yeah.
Yes, it's very important because the more educated people are, the less aggressive they are and the more enlightened they are about governance policies.
To me, education is the fiber of the society.
Education has really done a lot because we really learn from different people, like professionals. We learn different skills. We are able to create jobs for ourselves because of the knowledge we get from different people.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The International Committee of the Red Cross warns hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan may face starvation and are in need of urgent international assistance to survive. The ICRC is appealing for an additional $19 million to cover some of the country's massive and growing humanitarian needs caused by more than 8 months of fighting. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
South Sudan has largely faded from the international headlines and become one of several silent or forgotten crises. But for the International Committee of the Red Cross, there is nothing silent about the tragedies affecting the estimated 1.2 million internally displaced people, as well as the 440,000 South Sudanese who have taken refuge in neighboring countries. The humanitarian agency says hundreds of thousands of those displaced are living in camps or temporary settlements, with many in remote locations far from services. The ICRC's head of operations for East Africa, Eric Markley, says the organization needs an extra $19 million to make sure these South Sudanese do not starve.
Basically, to ensure their survival, for 150,000 people that will be served, we have forecasted that they will not be able to be self-sustainable in the months to come. We want to make sure that these ones at least will not die of malnutrition.
The UN Children's Fund reports nearly 250,000 children are suffering severe acute malnutrition. The agency warns as many as 50,000 children are at risk of death if they do not receive appropriate treatment. The rainy season, which is due to last until the end of the year, and lack of security are hampering the ICRC's ability to deliver food by airplane or road. It is using airdrops, smaller aircraft, and helicopters, which adds to the expense of the operation. The United Nations estimates at least 10,000 people have been killed and many wounded since fighting erupted between the government and rebels in mid-December. Eric Markley says Red Cross specialized medical teams have been operating from the beginning of the conflict.
We have four surgical teams that are flying from one place to another. Where there are needs. We will be very close to 3,000 surgical interventions since December. It's a significant operation and a significant figure.
One of the agency's major activities in South Sudan is the protection of civilians and prisoners in areas of conflict. Markley says the ICRC has received permission from both warring parties to visit places of detention, and its staff is visiting nearly 4,000 detainees. He says the ICRC provides food, water, hygiene material, and some medication to prisoners from time to time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
People in Jonglei say their members of parliament are not delivering services to them, the people who elected them. But local lawmaker says that is not true and insists he has been working very hard to improve living conditions in Jonglei State. For VOA News, Jacob Achek sent us this report from Bor.
Some residents of Jonglei State said they have never seen any developmental project in their communities in the 3 years that saw Sudan being independent. Even an officer from the governor's office, Manyang Duanjok, says lawmakers are not doing their jobs.
And that's why we have hostile communities at grassroots. It is because they are not informed about the government and they don't even know their own MPs. When MPs are on recess, they visit their families in abroad. And this is the cause of all the mess we have in the country.
A teacher from Malek Secondary School, Nyok Maler, said the member of parliament for his area only pay attention to the constituency when there is a security problem. Other than that, he says,
the MPs have no plan for their constituencies when there is insecurity issues. That when they consult their constituencies, members like chiefs, and they talk on security issues. But without insecurity issues, they don't consult.
Gerenga God live in Jalepaya. He said lawmakers has never proposed projects that might help to develop the community.
There was no day whereby they came and they briefed those who voted for them to tell them what happened in the parliament. There's not a single day whereby they went to their constituency and write a proposal and take to the parliament to be discussed as a bill.
Then there is the question of how constituency development funds are used. Some residents of Bor County said they have no idea where the funds which are allocated every year by the national government are going or what being done with them. Arrow Abraham Woy, a resident of Bor, said lawmakers have to learn to communicate with their constituents.
To not come back to the grassroots level to tell us about what is happening in the parliament. We only see them maybe when they are coming for campaign, when they are coming on their own, on occasions that are or functions that are being held. But they don't come to inform us on what is happening.
But Philip Thornyok disagrees with the criticism of local representatives, including himself. Thorn, who represents Bor Town in the state assembly, says MPs listen to their constituents and launch projects that will benefit them. The first priority when they were elected in 2010 was to construct boreholes so that their constituents would have easy access to water and to improve transportation in Bor County. Thorn said that there are now 5 vehicles in the county that can access even remote firearms during the rainy seasons.
They asked the priorities. So what was done was brought up by the community, especially the leaders of the community, like chiefs. They were saying that, yes, they are lacking these internal roads, they are lacking water. So to go for roads was very expensive. So we took up water. At least 17 boreholes were established in all the boomers.
Thorn said they use constituency development fund to buy vehicle and build the borehole. So in east part of Jongola State, he said it is easy to see what is being done with CDF, and the criticism of lawmakers like him is undeserved. He did not say whether or not he goes back to his constituency to talk about development project or consult them over issues affecting the area. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. U.S. President Barack Obama is set to announce his plan for an expanded American military effort against Islamic State militants in the Middle East. Mr. Obama is giving a primetime television address tonight to describe the threat of the insurgents to U.S. national security and how he plans to combat it, possibly by expanding American airstrikes against militant strongholds in Iraq to Syria. Mr. Obama has told key government officials that he believes he has the authority to order an increased military offensive without congressional approval, but told four top lawmakers at a White House meeting yesterday that he would welcome a favorable legislative vote to show the country was united in fighting the militants. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says he will submit a bill to Parliament next week granting parts of the separatist East greater autonomy, but keeping them part of Ukraine. Mr. Poroshenko announced the move at a cabinet meeting yesterday. He promised special status to some areas of the rebel-controlled regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, but he rejected any talk of so-called federalization or total independence. Pro-Russian separatists have been battling government troops in eastern Ukraine in recent months. And finally, Pakistan's military says its warplane struck 3 hideouts at a Taliban stronghold near the Afghan border, killing 65 suspected militants. Officials say their airstrikes early today targeted militant hideouts in the North Waziristan tribal region, where the military has been conducting a major offensive in recent months. According to an official statement, the military first carried out airstrikes in the Datakel area, killing 35 people. Hours later, it targeted a village in the Shawal Valley, killing another 30 people. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
It's been 20 years since the International Conference on Population Development was held in Cairo. Many consider the landmark meeting's greatest achievement to be the recognition of women's rights and empowerment. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The UN Population Fund says the September 1994 conference linked population and development and focused on meeting the needs of individual women and men. The key to this new approach, it says, was empowering women and providing them with more choices through expanded access to education and health services, skill development, and employment. Secretary of State John Kerry, then a U.S. senator, was a delegate to the Cairo summit.
You know, I remember leading that delegation to Cairo back when there really was a conspiracy of silence on family planning, sexual and reproductive health, and reproductive rights. And a lot of folks back then were very frightened. They were still afraid to talk about the connections between women's empowerment and women's rights and development, let alone to think that we could actually turn the tide.
He says since 1994, the commitments made by nearly 180 governments shows that the tide is turning.
But it's not a done deal, and we all know that. There are places pushing back. There's a tide of resistance to modernity, and we see it playing out not just in the context of women's rights, but we see it playing out in every single respect with respect to opportunity and dignity and the ability of people to be able to share fully in the choices about their lives.
Nevertheless, Kerry says, more lives are being saved and more opportunities are being provided than ever before. Speaking at the U.S. Institute of Peace, the Secretary of State warns no country can progress if it ignores half its population.
From Kabul to Kinshasa to Kuala Lumpur, I have seen with my own eyes the extraordinary difference that it makes when women and girls can decide if and when to have children. When they're empowered, educated, and equipped to be able to contribute to a strong and a stable and a prosperous society.
He says the nations must adopt a zero-tolerance policy on discrimination, violence, and human rights abuses against women and men.
That violence has no place in the 21st century, period. And we're going to continue to do everything in our power to stop it.
Secretary Kerry adds that HIV/AIDS prevention must be part of any approach to development, and that family planning be fully integrated into those prevention efforts. He adds more must be done to provide economic opportunities to what he calls a staggering youth population. In many countries, most of the population is now under age 30. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with a traditional song, Yala Kitautu, by Victoria Ole.
Yala Kitautu, Yala Kitautu, Yala Kelly ni Nigeria, Yala ni Nigeria, Yala Kelly ni Nigeria, Yala ni Nigeria, Sudan, yala yala, oh hey, yala yala, hey hey hey, yala hey, yala yala, keli ni nanu tu, yala ni nanu tu, yala yala, kama ni najere, yala ni najere.
Been listening to Victoria Ole with that beautiful song, Yala Kitautu. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.